The content is the protected, copyrighted property of the Murthy Law Firm. Please listen to copyright information and restrictions at the end of this recording.
Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us for today's discussion on international students and the end of duration of status, a discussion of the new rules that are going to become effective from September 15th, 2026 onwards. I am Sheila Murthy, the President and CEO of the Murthy Law Firm, and I am delighted and honored to have you join us. And joining me for today's discussion are my esteemed colleagues at the Murthy Law Firm, Attorney Anna Stepanova and Chris Drynan. So we're going to talk about all of the latest changes and developments that will impact international students with respect to the Department of Homeland Security's final rule, which replaces the traditional duration of status, or D/S, with a fixed period of admission and new extension of status or stay procedures. Many of you may already know that in the past, F1 students were admitted for duration of status shown by the D/S on the Form I-94 when you entered the U.S. In practical terms, the student who continued to follow all the rules for maintenance of F1 student status could generally remain in the U.S. while the student completed the program of study and any authorized practical training. The new rule, effective from September 15, 2026, changes that framework. What does it do? It creates an immigration admission clock that students and schools now must track separately from the academic and the CVIS timeline. CVIS, of course, is the Student and Exchange Visitor Information System. This will also impact or affect travel, extensions of stay, a transfer to another school, educational objectives, later education or degrees, the optional practical training, STEM OPT, and possible employment while the application is pending. By way of quick background, the rule was published on July 17th of 2026, scheduled to take effect 60 days later on September 15th, 2026. Litigation is pending, and the effective date could be affected by a court order or a later Federal Register notice, or maybe congressional review, or the USCIS or ICE or CVIS taking some other kind of action. Please note that filing of a lawsuit in and of itself does not invalidate the rule. Therefore, whether you're a university, a student, an employer, you need to monitor developments closely on this hot topic and plan for what is likely to happen and what you need to be prepared for unless the Department of Homeland Security or a court directs otherwise. So with that, let me invite Anna first to explain the practical significance at this point for students and schools.
Thank you very much, Sheila. Thank you for the introduction. On the day of this recording, we are still about 2 weeks away from the planned going into effect of the final F1 rule. And our understanding is that there is a lawsuit that is currently pending, so we're watching to see what is going to happen with that lawsuit. But we are going to presume for the purposes of this podcast that the rule will go into effect as planned as of September 15th, 2026. So as you already mentioned, the most important change is the basic change from duration of status to fixed admission period, which is already the case with regard to many non-immigrant visa categories. And now F1 just joins most of the NIV categories, non-immigrant visa categories. Among other important changes are the transition rules for students who are already in the United States, and we're going to spend a couple of minutes on that and explain what the difference is. And also some academic restrictions that are very important to understand, especially for students who are going to be coming in after on or after September 15th, 2026.
So Chris, from a practical real world point of view, how does this affect students who are trying to make important decisions about their lives?
Thank you, Sheila. This does have some important considerations. This basically, anyone who is in student status or is considering student status is going to have to think about the changes that are coming from these new rules, especially perhaps changes in employment authorization, such as practical training, curricular practical training, optional practical training, or the STEM extension. You have to think about how this rule is going to affect that or potentially not affect it in some cases. We have lots of unanswered questions here, but I guess the overarching thing here is everyone has to remember that it's not just the I-20 anymore. Each student's situation is going to be affected on a variety of different issues that you didn't necessarily have to consider so much before. It's the I-20, of course, but it's also their I-94, their CVIS history, the dates of their program, duration of any employment authorization, their travel history, and any pending applications. So it's kind of a wider universe of things that everyone is going to have to take into consideration at this point if these new rules go into effect on September 15th.
Thank you, Chris. So now let's get started with the most important concept. As we said, under the new framework, students need to track two separate clocks. The first is the academic and the CVIS clock. It's reflected on the form I-20 and the related school records. This information includes the student's program, enrollment, program end date, DSO or International Student Advisor's recommendations, and practical training experience or information. The second, of course, is the immigration admission clock. That clock is reflected on the form I-94 card, right? And that's generally what you get when you enter the U.S. and the Customs and Border Protection issues that, and it controls how long DHS has authorized the student to remain in a valid legal status in the United States. And although these two clocks are related, they are not identical and they're not interchangeable. So for example, a DSO may extend a student's program in CVIS and issue an updated I-20. That updated I-20 does not in and of itself extend the student's I-94 card or immigration period of authorized stay. When additional time is needed beyond the current admission period, the student will now generally be required to file and obtain an extension of stay either from the USCIS or depart the U.S. and seek readmission back into the U.S. and get the new I-94 issued by CBP at the border, at the port of entry. So from a practical consideration, Anna, if I can have you, could you explain the significance for students and for schools with this change?
Absolutely, Sheila. This is a major practical change. So what all of the schools, DSOs, and their international students are used to is to watch the I-20 form and make sure that they see this record is valid and the I-20 is not expired, or if the student is on OPT, their EAD has not expired and or they're in the grace period. However, you know, this is not enough anymore. So what is added to that is also a requirement to make sure that the I-94 doesn't expire. And as you just mentioned, Sheila, the end date of the I-94 and the end date of the student's program of study as noted on the I-20 form may not be the same. So what the rule says is that a one-time limitation is up to 4 years. But it doesn't mean that a student is not eligible for an extension of the four-year limit. What it means is that the maximum that can be issued to a student on the form I-94 is 4 years or up to the end of their program of study, whichever happens first. And the 30-day period that is given to students to enter the U.S. before the program of study starts, and this 30-day grace period after the end of the program of study are not included in the four-year limitation. So just to kind of put it in perspective, let's look at an example of a PhD student who is coming to the U.S. with an I-20 issued for a five-year PhD program. When they present themselves at the border, CBP will not issue them an I-94 that's valid for 5 years, but they will only issue them an I-94 that is valid for a four-year period. So at the end of that 4 years, the student must apply for an extension of their program with USCIS to make sure that the I-94 remains valid and they're actually able to complete their PhD program while maintaining their student status.
Excellent point. Excellent. Very nice example. Great. Truly explains how the process works. So with the shorter post-completion period, Chris, how does this issue affect students in real-world planning and decision-making?
This is another important change. All of us who have been doing this for a while have become accustomed to the 60-day preparation for departure period, or what people generally call the grace period. Historically, after you complete your degree or you complete your practical training, you have a 60-day departure period. That's not the case anymore. Under the new fixed-date I-94 system, the grace period has been reduced from that 60 days that we're all used to down to 30 days. Big difference if you're trying to do various things, change status, depart the country. 30 days is a lot less than 60. So something that people have to consider. Another thing to consider, and this is not necessarily a change, not really a change, the 30-day period is not an unrestricted employment period. If you want to work, you have to have a separate legal authorization. And you shouldn't assume that having a pending application permits you to work or extends your employment authorization. Sometimes it does, but don't assume it. You have to have specific authorization, and that automatic extension has to be specifically permitted. Now, students who are covered by the transition rules generally will retain the 60-day grace period as long as they remain within the transition framework of these new rules. But if you are a transition student and you travel and are readmitted to the United States again, or if you receive an I-94 that has a definite date on it, a fixed date, through an extension or a change of status, you're not in the transition rules anymore. You're going to move into the new system, and you're going to be subject to the 30-day grace period, not the 60 days.
Wow, that's a lot for people to bite. And if somebody is not watching or aware or constantly monitoring it, it's easy for it to slip through the cracks, right? So obviously, as you just heard, both Anna and Chris talk about this, the rule does not provide permanent grandfathering for every student who is in the U.S. Instead, it provides some type of temporary transition treatment for students who may qualify. So a student will generally need to have been admitted for duration of status before September 15, 2026, then be physically present in the U.S. in F1 status on September 15, 2026, and be validly maintaining that status on that date to enjoy some of these benefits. And in that case, the student may remain under the transition framework without immediately filing any type of form I-539 until the earliest applicable endpoint. For a student in a program, that endpoint is generally the program end date as shown on that I-20 that is valid on September 15, 2026, or 4 years from September 15, 2026, whichever comes first. The applicable 60-day legacy period that Chris just explained follows that same endpoint. For a student who's already in post-completion or STEM OPT, the EAD expiration date that is valid on September 15th of 2026 could very well be the relevant endpoint followed by the applicable 60-day grace period. But if the four-year transition maximum controls, the 4 years will end on September 15th of 2030. The 60-day period would then end on November 14th of 2030. The student's I-94 may still display D/S for those students who have never traveled the entire time, but the student can no longer rely only on the face of that I-94 card or document. The student needs to calculate the transition deadline based on the rule and the applicable program or the EAD endpoint. So, Anna, could you explain the practical significance of how this impacts students and schools?
Yes. There are a lot of dates, Sheila, that for students to remember. But what is also very important to keep in mind is that the transition rule is not a grandfathering rule, as you just noted. And students who are outside the United States on September 15th or whenever the rule goes into effect, or those students who are in the U.S., but they are in violation, present in violation of their F1 status on that date, they are not going to qualify for this transition treatment. Students also can break the transition benefit by traveling or by applying to USCIS for an extension, for example. Also, a transition student who departs on or after September 15th and is readmitted will generally receive a dated I-94, and they will have 4 years or a shorter period of time up to the end of their program of study or OPT plus 30 days, not 60 days as under the transition rules, but only under 30 days. Also, reentry is never guaranteed. CBP has wide discretion to admit a student, but if they admit a student, they will generally issue a fixed admit until date after September 15th. 2026.
So, Chris, if a student needs more time, how would this impact the student in terms of planning and decision making?
Well, I mean, if you need additional time, you have two basic paths, and neither one is 100% safe. They both have issues. First one is you do an extension of stay through USCIS. DSO would have to go into the CBIS database and issue a new I-20 form. You would then have to file an I-539 application with USCIS to extend your status. And that requires various evidence, possibly biometrics and an interview. And then it's USCIS who decides whether to grant the extension or not. Second option is actual departure from the United States, followed by reentering and a request for readmission at Customs and Border Protection. This also has its own issues. I mean, do you have a valid visa? Your travel documents valid? Do you have any issues that affect your admissibility to the country? And also always the possibility that CBP is going to ask you more questions or possibly even deny your admission. So that's going to make a lot of people say, well, why don't I just file an extension? That also has its own issues, particularly if you need to travel. Because if you need to travel while you've got a pending I-539, USCIS can deem that I-539, in other words, the extension, abandoned. And it's also important to remember that employment authorization is not automatically treated in the same way as an extension. If you're considering traveling while a filing is pending, you should carry your receipt notice, carry your new I-20. But you really should talk to someone who's familiar with the rules here before you travel, because it has its own problems. It's not without risk. And particularly in the current environment, problems with CBP when you're coming back in are not out of the question.
Okay. Thank you. There's also a separate, I guess, issue about the new restrictions on changing schools and educational objectives for students below the graduate level, meaning undergrad or AA degree or whatever you're pursuing. Transfers and changes in educational objectives generally are restricted during the first academic year of the program unless the Student and Exchange Visitor Program, or SEVP, approves an exception based on extenuating circumstances. On the other hand, for graduate-level students, the rule is even stricter. A graduate student generally may not change educational objectives at any point during the master's degree program. A transfer to another school is also generally prohibited unless SEVP approves an exception based on extenuating circumstances. Educational objective is broader than an informal change in interest. Depending on the circumstances, it can include the student's program of study, a major, an educational level as reflected in the school and the CDIS record. So lots of restrictions. So again, how does this ultimately end up impacting or being of practical significance for students and for schools, Anna?
There is a lot that is still unclear based on the rule, but you are absolutely right, Sheila. It's very restrictive, and it looks very restrictive for those students who are at the below graduate level and above graduate level and above. We don't know, for example, how SEVP is going to approve an exception based on extenuating circumstances. So we'll have to kind of watch and see how they go about it. And Chris will probably touch on extenuating circumstances themselves. What is the definition? We don't know that. So for those students who are below the graduate level, gone are the days when they could come with two I-20s initially and change their school even before registering for classes. And for graduate students and above, what is unknown is whether a change in the field of their research or dissertation field will result in a prohibited change of the programs, or will it be considered to be the same program? So these are all of the issues that are still somewhat unclear.
Okay, thank you, Anna. I guess then jumping to your point, which Anna just referred to Chris about the extenuating circumstances, how does this issue affect students in terms of what are the extenuating circumstances, if any, that they can look to?
Well, this is potentially a huge issue, Sheila, because the extenuating circumstances exception process here is discretionary to the government. It's not enough for your school's DSO to think the transfer is reasonable. SEVP also has to approve it. So this could be things like illness or disability, the closure of the school, inability of the school to offer courses that you need, or other things like natural disasters or emergencies, things that are really beyond your control. I mean, some other things like, the departure of your advisor or a funding program or concerns about perhaps discrimination, things like this may or may not be relevant, but don't assume that's going to be approved. It's ultimately up to SEVP, and they might not consider all of these to be sufficient grounds here. And for an extension of stay, I mean, the rule does recognize certain compelling academic reasons. These can be things like an unexpected change of your advisor, refinement research topic, unexpected problems with your research, or delays in funding. Also, compelling medical reasons or circumstances that are really beyond the student's control might be relevant. Things like academic probation, suspension, or an inability or unwillingness to complete the program are not going to be acceptable reasons. And the standards for an SEVP transfer exception and a USCIS extension of stay are related, but they're not necessarily the same thing, and nor should they be treated as one automatic test. Because these are basically, I'd say, each situation has to stand on its own.
Talking about second degrees at the same level or a lower level. So another significant provision, as we've seen, is later educational programs. Under the general rule, an F1 student who completes a program of study in the U.S. on or after September 15th of 2026, the effective date of this new rule, may begin another program of study, but only at a higher educational level. Gone are the days of two masters, two, three bachelors, whatever, right? A bachelor's to master's, or a master's to a doctorate progression would be considered consistent with the new rule. But a second bachelor's offering after completion of the first bachelor's, the second master's degree after completing one master's, or a doctorate going back to a master's progression would generally be considered barred or prohibited. Programs that have been completed prior to September 15th of 2026 do not count towards this new restriction. So for example, a student who just completed a master's in, you know, May, June of 2026, before the effective date of this new rule, could potentially go ahead and do another master's degree, etc. So the rule does not comprehensively define every educational level comparison, professional degrees, certificates, post-master's programs. Two specialized master's degrees, for example, may raise difficult questions. And the DHS has also reserved authority to delay or suspend implementation of the academic restrictions for technical reasons or for up to 2 years, with advance notice through official channels. So students who are considering another degree need to obtain advice and get clarification before they jump into it and realize it's probably denied or going to be denied or you're deemed a violation of your status. Okay, what about CPT, OPT, STEM OPT? What happens for those students under the new rule, Anna?
So interestingly enough, the new rule does not address CPT. CPT is going to be authorized by the DSO just like it is now. And OPT will generally be following the same procedure, plus the student will have to file a form I-539 with USCIS. So two different forms, 765 for OPT, as students do now. They apply on the form I-765 under the current rule, but also they will have to add on an I-539, very similar to what some non-immigrants on H-4 are doing right now when they're extending their H-4 status and they're applying for employment authorization, the so-called H-4 EAD. So the concept is going to be very, very similar. And same with regard to STEM OPT. So 539 for STEM OPT plus 765 as is the requirement right now. Under the transition rules, the students who are applying for OPT or STEM OPT within 6 months after September 15th will not have to file a form I-539. So that's a benefit. And somebody who is in F1 status in the U.S. and who is going to have to apply for OPT within 6 months may decide not to travel so that they don't lose this benefit under the transition rules.
Great. Okay. This is really helpful. At least there seems to be one small silver lining in this dark cloud. So I guess how does this, you know, what has not changed? How does this issue affect students with respect to what has remained the same, Chris?
Well, that's true. Some things are pretty much the same and some important concepts remain the same. The I-20 form and the CVIS database record remain essential to anyone who's here on student status. You have to continue to follow the school's instructions, keep the course load that's required, and comply with all the normal EFRIN requirements. OPT and the STEM OPT extension are both available, but you have to coordinate a little bit more here because potentially you have your I-765 that you use to apply for the OPT, your I-94, which determines your period of legal status in the United States, and the necessity of potentially having to extend that by filing an I-539 to extend your student status. Curricular practical training still available, still authorized by the DSO, and this rule does not eliminate curricular practical training or automatically make every request for CPT more restrictive. Main change here is the fixed admissions and the fact that pending extension of stay filings may affect whether a student can stay here and whether your employment can continue. Visa expiration date, EAD expiration date, your program end date, and the date on your I-94 admission record may all be different, and you have to keep track of that. This is a lot to keep track of, and it's really very easy for someone to make a mistake and really get into trouble here with all these different dates you have to keep track of, because they each apply to different things now.
Yep, you're so right. So from a practical planning checklist, you know, before you make a major decision, you as a student needs to check four things. First, you check your status. Are you maintaining a full course of study and complying with all your F1 requirements? Second, check your admission date. What does the current I-94 state? Is the student subject to a separately calculated transition deadline, even if the I-94 still says D/S? Third, check your academics. Is the proposed transfer, major change, educational level change, or later degree permitted, right? And fourth, check your procedures. Does the student need a new I-20, a form I-539, form 765, travel, readmission, reinstatement, or an SEVP exception? Is the filing made before the program end date or only during the departure period? That timing may determine whether employment can continue or not. So students need to retrieve and review the electronic I-94 after every reentry into the U.S. after international travel. A student's record, a visa, the EAD, I-94, all may show different dates and have different legal significance. So, Anna, is there anything you want to add while we wrap this up?
Yes. So for students who are going to become subject to the new rules, there are several very important moments to pause and kind of see what their next step is going to be and obtain advice. I would recommend that they speak with their DSO and they speak with a knowledgeable attorney, immigration attorney. Before international travel, it's something that they need to consider. How is it going to change their current situation? Before their I-94 expires or transition period expires, before they change schools or programs of study, before extending the program or applying for OPT, before beginning another degree. So all of those trigger events can result in some very bad consequences and results if the student doesn't think about what it means under the new rule. So obtain advice. It's a lot to understand, a lot to consider, but DSOs are very knowledgeable. But most importantly, immigration attorneys can provide good advice and to direct you in the right direction so that you don't fall out of status.
Thank you, Anna. So let's close with then three takeaways, right? First, check your I-94 card. For a transition student, calculate the transition deadline, even if the I-94 continues to say D/S. Second, plan before you travel. If you're readmitted after travel, you will generally enter with the fixed date system and you will lose these transition benefits. Third, ask before you change your school, your program, your educational objectives, or your degree level. And we recommend a fourth takeaway, which is monitor official updates. This rule is brand new. Implementation and guidance is developing. Litigation is possible. A later federal register, the decision from the litigation that's pending obviously could change everything, or a later federal register notice could impact whether or when this rule takes effect. And in conclusion, finally, Chris, did you want to help anything with, like, you know, what they could do?
Well, one thing to remember here is that you should premium processing right now is not available for extensions of status for I-539's extensions. So you shouldn't plan your timelines around premium processing being available unless USCIS officially starts to allow premium processing for these cases. An I-539 these days can take sometimes more than 12 months. So don't expect that you're going to be able to premium process these extensions because you might not be able to.
Thank you, Chris. In view of the time that we have and in view of how many nuances and complexity and changes that could continue, I hope that this presentation with Anna, Chris, and myself, Sheila Murthy, has given you a broad framework of what is out there, what is mentioned in the DHS final rule, what we expect and what we're seeing at this stage. Obviously, it's very early in the rule. The rule has not become effective yet, and there's litigation that's already pending. So we all need to sit and monitor. And, of course, at the Murthy Law Firm, we will continue to share important updates and information with you all. On behalf of myself, Sheila Murthy, on behalf of Anna Stepanova, on behalf of Chris Drynan and the entire team at the Murthy Law Firm, we hope that you have some important and valuable information you gained, and we will continue to explain and provide updates to you as we see changes happening. Thank you so much for joining us today. Have a wonderful rest of your day. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Unauthorized recording or dissemination of these materials without prior permission is prohibited by law. Learn about our firm, how to engage our services, and more at www.murthy.com.